124.
That's a good reputation.
House Committee on Judiciary Committee, today is May 14th, 2013. First item on the agenda is open a public hearing on Senate Bill 124. Mr. Taylor.
Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 124 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs. Requires the courts to consider defendant service member status at sentencing. Declares emergency effective upon passage. You have before you the Dash 1 amendments, which Representative Hicks has been very instrumental in putting together. And how that would change the bill, it would allow the court to only consider for mitigation. Not that I need to consider upward departure or anything like that. But it would instead of saying shall consider, it would say may consider. And the significance of that is it would not raise post-conviction relief issues.
Very good.
Thank you. Jess Barton and David Amsbury, please. Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Barton. I'm an adjunct faculty member in the Criminal Justice Department at Western Oregon University. I'm also a criminal defense attorney, member of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm also a member of the State Bar's Military Assistance Panel and of its Executive Committee and its Military and Veterans Law Section. And I'm also an Army veteran, which probably is what motivates my work on this kind of legislation. This bill, Senate Bill 124, actually is the second half of a bill that was initially sponsored in 2009, House Bill 3396. What that bill actually had in it was two parts. One part which would allow or broaden district attorney's authority to divert from prosecution veteran defendants charged with crimes, so long as they meet the definition of service member, which is defined in terms of type of discharge a person receives. That portion of House Bill 3396 actually passed in 2010 as Senate Bill 999. Senate Bill 124 represents the second half of House Bill 3396. It authorizes or it clarifies that trial courts have authority to mitigate sentences in veteran defendant cases, again using that service member definition that comes out of Senate Bill 999. So in a case, for example, involving a veteran defendant who suffers from, let's say, post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury, if the court concludes that the veteran defendant's service member status substantially and compellingly justifies it, the court could impose, for example, probation instead of an incarceration sentence. This bill is really part of a multifaceted approach to focus attention on these veteran defendant cases. I do want to give you a couple of statistics. In 2007, an organization called the Pacific Policy Research Institute worked in conjunction with the Marion County Jail to do a study of the characteristics of the jail's inmates. About 5.5% of jail inmates in 2007 were veterans. They did a second study in 2011. In 2011, 9.8% of jail inmates were veterans. So there was about an 80% increase in the number of veterans that were incarcerated in the Marion County Jail over that three-year period. So this is what actually focuses our attention on this entire thing, is to ensure that in these veteran defendant cases, the cases are properly handled in terms of the defense attorneys primarily, and of course the trial courts as well, and in terms of Senate Bill 99, the district attorneys all kind of coming together and ensuring that the cases are properly handled to try to avoid incarcerating veteran defendants in cases where avoiding incarceration is appropriate. The bill, as it was originally came through the Senate, it would have mandated consideration of this mitigating factor, but through the Dash 1 amendments, which the bar supports, the Dash 1 amendments would change that mandatory consideration into a discretionary consideration by the trial court. The burden is going to really fall on the defense bar. The defense bar is going to be the one that's going to need to put together the kind of case, kind of make the kind of presentation to a trial court in order to ensure the trial court's judgment that exercise of this discretionary authority should be done and should be mitigated. I think that is the extent of my remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
committee has any questions for me, I'll stop there.
Are there any questions?
Would you like me to wait, Mr. Chair?
Why don't you wait? Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Amesbury. I'm a prosecutor with the Benton County District Attorney's Office. I'm also a member of the ODAA Legislative Committee, a former cavalry officer and United States Army veteran. I would like to speak to the bill as it came through from the Senate, Senate Bill 124. I can report that as far as the committee, the Legislative Committee of the ODAA is concerned, their position on the bill is neutral. However, during the discussions and review of the bill, an issue arose that I think will be addressed in the Dash 1 if this committee adopts the Dash 1. And that issue was, as the committee probably knows, an aggravating factor is something that would allow a court to impose a harsher sentence on a defendant than the judge otherwise might do. A mitigating factor is one that would allow the court to impose a more lenient sentence. As drafted, the bill would permit a court to either impose a harsher sentence because someone is a service member or a more lenient sentence because someone is a service member. And the committee had some concerns about whether that was first the intent of the legislature in passing, and second of all, whether that would be an appropriate to have an Oregon law. And as an example of how it didn't seem to be what the legislature would intend, because the definition of service member in the statute includes active members, members of the National Guard, reserves, honorably discharged veterans, generally discharged veterans of all types, but excludes dishonorably discharged veterans, then a service member who was fell under the statute and an honorable discharge could be penalized for being a veteran, while a service member who had a dishonorable discharge would not fall under the statute and could not be penalized. So that appeared as an anomaly to us. I cannot report to you the committee's response to the Dash 1 amendment that's been proposed, and that's only because that has not been circulated to our committee, and so I can't speak on behalf of the committee. I can report that based on the discussions the committee had regarding the proposed bill, or the Senate Bill 124 as it passed from the Senate, that the Dash 1 amendment would seem to address the concerns that the committee had. Speaking for myself as an Army veteran, I think most veterans do not request special treatment when they come before the government or before courts, but certainly we would not be expecting to be treated less favorably because we had served our countries. So those are my remarks, and if the committee has any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Okay. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few questions. The first one, Mr. Barton, in your testimony, and I ask you to bear with me, I don't practice this area of law, I think you used a term of art, I think you said substantially and materially. Evidently, that's the standard, I suppose.
Substantial and compelling.
So what is that standard, and where does that come from?
That comes from the felony sentencing guidelines.
Okay.
The felony sentencing guidelines set out a series of aggravating and mitigating factors that a court can impose instead of what's called a presumptive sentence.
Right.
And the court can go above or below what the presumptive sentence is based on aggravating and mitigating factors if the court finds that those factors are substantially compelling.
Gotcha.
So you say substantially and compellingly justify mitigation or aggravation as the case may be.
Thank you. I was unaware of that standard. Follow-up, please. Not really a follow-up, it's an entirely separate question. In Section 2 of the bill, the amendments that apply to sentences imposed on or after the effective date of this act for crimes committed before, on, or after the effective date. And let me see, I just want to make sure that we understand exactly what we're doing. I don't want to end up inadvertently in a situation in which we are essentially revisiting sentences that have already been imposed, dragging in victims for a second sentencing, etc. So, as I read that right there, I think we are good. Sentences that have already been imposed as of the effective date of this act will not be revisited because of this bill. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, that is correct. If sentence is imposed on or after the effective date of this act, then the act would apply. So if somebody's already been sentenced, somebody was sentenced the day before, too late.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, that would also be my reading.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Okay, thank you. Oh, wait, sorry, Representative Hicks.
Mr. Barton, thank you so much for doing this bill.
Chairman, thank you, Representative Hicks. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate what you're doing, too.
Thank you.
So, and you know, I know that it seemed like it went a little awry at this point, but I greatly appreciate your willingness to continue honing this legislation with us. I'm very excited about this piece of legislation, so thanks.
I've appreciated your assistance, too, Representative Hicks. I have certainly done that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 124.
Chair, I'd like to move the dash one amendments into House Bill one, Senate Bill 124.
Representative Krieger moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 124. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 124 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Krieger would like to move Senate Bill 124 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And Representative Hicks, would you carry for it? We'll ask Representative Matthews to be a carrier. Thank you. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 125.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 125 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar again, the dash A version of the bill. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this directs agencies in contested case hearings to comply with the Service Member Civil Relief Act by giving notice to parties of the right of active duty service members and include certain other information with this notice concerning who they can contact for help. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's been federal law in this area since the Civil War requiring some kind of notice.
Once again, Mr. Barton, please.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, I'm Jesse Barton. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar's, the Executive Committee of its Military and Assistance Panel. This bill actually is the last chapter, I think, in ensuring statewide compliance with the Service Member Civil Relief Act. Private parties were brought into compliance in 2009 through passage of House Bill 2303, which I think, Mr. Chairman, you'll remember very well, the work you did on that. The Judicial Department voluntarily complied with the SERA's requirements of similar of the sort that we see in this particular House or Senate bill. That was done in 2008, 2009, and other state agencies, I know the Bureau of Labor and Industries already is in compliance with the notification requirements, I would call them, of the Service Member Civil Relief Act. But the point with this SCRA does is it allows judicial proceedings to be stayed for a minimum of 90 days when a person is called on to active duty service. And judicial proceedings is defined to include by the SCRA is defined to include both court proceedings and administrative proceedings. If a person goes on to active duty and has, for example, an administrative proceeding pending, an administrative law judge can stay the proceedings for 90 days. If the service member's military service is going to materially affect his ability to represent himself or herself in the administrative proceeding. If the service member that's actually the ALJ has permission to stay the proceeding for 90 days under those circumstances. If the service member requests a stay, then it's mandatory under federal law. But what this bill does is it has two parts. It's section one, requires state agencies to notify parties of their SCRA rights so they're well informed that they can stay the proceedings for this 90-day period, or even a longer period if they can establish that a 90-day stay will not be long enough, that they're going to be on deployment to Afghanistan for a year or something like that. A 90-day stay isn't going to do them much good. So they could ask for a one-year stay or whatever, a year and a half stay or whatever the case, what might they determine might be required. Section 2 of the bill requires agencies to notify potential parties of their SCRA rights. So when for example, the Office of Administrative Hearings sends out notification to a person that your driver's license is going to be suspended, you can request a hearing, then that notification needs to also state the person has certain SCRA rights that they might want to see observed. The bill was amended coming out of the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee to have an emergency clause. That emergency clause was eliminated in the Senate Judiciary Committee and replaced with a September 1st effective date. That was to give the administrative agencies time to gear up and meet these notification requirements. Also, the bill also was amended to specify the kind of notification standards that have to be made by the administrative agencies. And also, the bill was amended to allow administrative agencies to exhaust their store of previously printed forms so that they don't have to go out and throw out all those forms and buy a bunch of new ones. And that was done to avoid a fiscal impact, as I understand it. And that's the extent of my presentation, Mr. Chairman. If the committee has any questions, I'm going to stop.
Are there any questions for Mr. Barton? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 125B and open a work session on Senate Bill 125B.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 125B to the floor if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 125B to the floor if it do pass. Is there any discussion?
Question, Mr. Chair.
Question.
Is there a proposed Dash 9 amendment? Or am I mistaken? Am I confused? It's distinctly possible I made that up, but it would be an odd thing for me to make up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there was an A9 amendment adopted in another committee, but we're now talking about the B
and girls.
The bill.
Okay.
So, and that was the issue of the effective date being September 13th.
That's already been adopted. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Stand corrected.
Thank you. Any further questions? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Should we have Representative Matthews carry that one again? Or Representative Matthews will be the carrier. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 623A.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 623A comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary at the request of the Oregon Law Commission, adopts new rules clarifying access for court records in adoption cases, creates segregated adoption summary and segregated information statements holding the most sensitive information to be filed with the adoption petition. Chairman of the committee, once again, it comes from the Oregon Law Commission. I see Mr. Shetterly here. And
Mr. Shetterly, Ms. Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly. I'll be brief and turn it over to Wendy, and then we have some other members of the work group here today. On this bill, this is a bill that I mentioned last week, I think, when we were here on the juvenile records bill, that we had two that came to the Law Commission from the Oregon Judicial Department coming up through their e-court work, getting ready for going live statewide on e-court. That raises an issue of how they handle records, who has access to what records. And just as in our bill last week, dealing with juvenile records, now we're dealing with adoption records, that work really exposed some deficiencies in current law relative to access to adoption records. It's frankly a mess. And so we were pleased when the Judicial Department brought this to us. We formed a work group. John DeLorenzo, a commissioner on the commission, chaired the work group, and it was probably the largest work group, I think, that we may have ever assembled for a law commission project, broadly representative. If you can imagine, adoption carries a lot of passion. It's not only legally complex, but it's something that people feel passionate about and from many different perspectives. And so we brought together a broadly representative work group that's identified in the Law Commission report that you have with you. And I'm pleased to say that what you have in this bill represents a consensus product of that very diverse work group. You'll hear from some of the work group members today. I think I want to leave my introductory remarks there and let Wendy walk you through the bill, and then we'll have an opportunity to bring some of the work group members forward, and you can hear from them firsthand their support for the product that is coming to you today. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Ms. Johnson, if you could just give us a summary of the changes, it would be great. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission. As Commissioner Shetterly explained, we have provided you with a report that explains our thought process throughout the project. We've also provided you ORS 7.211. The reason for that is that statutes are repealed by the bill. That's in a separate statute, a whole other chapter of law. Instead, we're focusing putting all the records provisions regarding adoption into the adoption chapter in Chapter 109, but so that you can see what we had before. We thought it would be helpful to just, for you to see it. But ORS 7.211 is the existing statute. It says that all adoption records are sealed and that you need a court order to access them. So anybody could theoretically get a copy of it because you just need a court order, but there's no criteria to describe when is a court supposed to allow access to records. And so this bill, there were two focus. One, figuring out how to organize the file in the court and what's supposed to go in that file, and then second, who should have access to that file and at what time. So the bill focuses on those two parts. Page 3 of the report does give you the whole list of the work group. Oregon has long allowed adoptees to have access to their birth certificate since ballot measure 58. So you need to keep that in mind, that some states have a much more closed system, and we do not have that system. We require access to medical reports and the birth certificate and things already to the adoptee. I'll try to keep my comments brief. Section, the bill, section 1 is the definition section, like most law commission bills, and we use those definitions throughout the bill. The main thing that the bill does is create a new segregated portion of the adoption file, which we call the adoption, the adoption summary and segregated information statement. Basically, this has the contact information and contact information like phone numbers and addresses and things, and the most confidential information. And those we have determined are three things: the home study or written evidence of the home study, the adoption report, which is the form that goes to vital statistics to create the birth certificate, and the medical history. Those three documents and this statement that has all the contact information would be segregated, and then the rest of the file would still be in this adoption court file that is not subject to the public, but it would help organize it for requests later, because then we use those two terms, the regular adoption record and the segregated information. And so then the main focus of the bill is providing rules for the court on who will have access when. So the way this is all in Section 6. So in Section 6 provides that the judge and court staff, the petitioners, that would be the adoptive parents, attorneys for the petitioners, and DHS will have access to that record, the whole record, at all times, instead of, as in present law, you have to get a court order. And those persons do get the records now, because most of them were filed by them. It's just that it's inefficient for the court and for attorneys and the parties to, every time they need something from the file, to have to get a court order, especially as we go electronic. Attorneys of record will want to be able to access that online instead of having to literally go to the courthouse, do a motion, and get a copy. So those listed persons would have access at all times. Then this Section 6 also goes on to explain that adoptees will have access to the file when they turn 18, with the exception of the home study, and that's the most confidential of documents. It has financial information and things about their adoptive parents and such. But the work group had consensus that document should be kept confidential unless there's good cause to allow it, and so even that document could be disclosed to the adoptee upon motion. And the reasoning for that, at first blush it might sound like a big change, but the reasoning behind that is that we are an open courts state. Our Constitution under Article 1, Section 10 says we're open court, and then we've also had a voluntary registry in Oregon since 1983, so adoptees at age 18 already can voluntarily be matched. Also at age 18, they're required to get their medical information. And then, as I said, ballot measure 58 passed. That requires disclosure of the adopted or the birth parents' names. So that matching can already happen, and the policy has already been made to share that information. So allowing adoptees to get the court records is the logical extension of that allowance of already getting vital statistics information. And lastly, the present statute already allows discretion for the court to release the same information, but there just aren't any guidelines. So this, the way Section 6 is written, it provides guidelines of which documents and at what time, and that would not be releasable until age 18. Then in the next part of the bill, also in Section 6, it provides that those who gave consent for the adoption, that would normally be both the birth mother and birth father, although sometimes the birth father is not known at the time, those persons would have the ability to get the court records when the adoptee also reaches 18. This would be still on motion, but the presumption would be that the court would release that information unless there was good cause not to. So it's giving more guidance to the court on what to do with those requests. And then lastly, there's still a catch-all that would allow anyone else to petition. It could be a sibling or something, someone else. Again, this would be the present standard, which is to do a motion, but the standard would be good cause. This work group is intending to continue working in the adoption area to work on more of the substance. This project was focused on records, and so we plan to revisit the other persons later. It's been suggested, for example, to provide more notice to the adoptee and the adoptive parents before others are getting these access, and we'd like to explore that more, but we need more time. But we're not changing that standard. It would still be, do you need to do a motion? The bill goes on to explain that for DHS adoptions, there's an exception. And a DHS adoption means that a parent's parental rights have been terminated, and the only way to terminate those is they agree to it, or there's such serious conditions that those rights are terminated. It's usually criminal activity that's a danger to the child. So the standards are quite different. In some DHS adoptions, it is open. But the presumption, not even a presumption, the rule would be that records would not be releasable to those birth parents in the DHS types adoption. And that seems to be practice and would be necessary for protection of the family. So the adoptees could still get it, but it would be a prohibition of names and addresses and that types of thing for the DHS cases to the birth parents. There's another exception for signers. If you created a document and filed it with the court, you should be able to get a copy of that document, was the belief. I just want to put in the record for that. We put an exception that if there's a signature of someone else, that would not be disclosable. We intend that to include the signature line. So if you printed the name as well, that other person's name would not be disclosable. It's particularly an issue with post-adoption compact agreements where there may be another page tacked onto that agreement that the other party didn't see, and it shouldn't be disclosed. We also cleared up that DHS and adoption agencies can use records to do their job. There are provisions in an existing law that seem to require agencies and DHS to even get a court order to use the records, and we clarify that they can use those records. That's important because right now DHS is literally having to get a court order every time as well. We clean up the petitionless adoptions, which is in the DHS dependency type chapter, and require the same statement of the and segregation of those most important confidential materials so that whether they're filed in family court under a regular adoption under 109 or whether in dependency, that the same segregation will be done. Apparently that isn't always consistent in Oregon now, but adoption cases are supposed to be treated differently and are supposed to be sealed, and so we need to make sure that no matter which forum, that they will be treated the same. The other sections of the bill are largely cleanup. For example, there's an ICWA provision that was missing in one of the DHS statutes. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I do have two adoption attorneys who will be who are with us that will provide more of the practical what's happening, why this bill is good policy. The short of it is that adoptees that are, when they reach 18, will now be ensured that they have access to the records. Parents will have more predictable access, and petitioners, DHS, and the judges and attorneys will now have much more efficient access, and the statutes. We also did a large amount of cleanup of just what you have to file for paper, and that's all listed out in a much more organized manner so that new attorneys especially and judges now know, what do I have to get this adoption finished? It's all organized of what is actually filed in the petition rather than attached as an exhibit, so we've really organized that file. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wendy, what happens with files that are already on file for their summary and segregation information statement? How will this work with cases that are already filed closed.
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, we thought of that issue. Of course, new cases will have to have this new statement of the adoption summary and segregated information statement. The prior cases, we've listed out those same requirements of the home study, the adoption report, and the medical report. We've listed them out because there is no summary statement, but we've said that those three documents should be treated the same. I think I failed to mention that, but those three documents are not presumed to go to the birth parents, and that's the main reason for segregating it. And it's an organizational tool for the courts to use to recognize that, okay, those are the most, those the court should be circumspect with others, and particularly birth parents on those three documents because they have the most sensitive information.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. Thank you. Robin Pope and Laura Batt, please.
Would it be all right if John Weber also
yes.
came up? He's a member of the
group. It would be.
Also.
It would be fine.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Robin Pope. I'm an attorney in private practice. My practice is limited to adoptions and related matters. I've listed some of my qualifications in my testimony, which I believe you've received via email. I've served on prior law commission work groups, two prior work groups, and this one. I've also helped DHS when we've done review and rewriting of Oregon administrative rules regarding adoption. So I think I bring with me many years of experience in this area of law, and I would like to encourage you to support our bill. And I'm here to talk to you about some of the practical, from my perspective as a practicing attorney, reasons why this bill is worth passing and implementing. I've listed just some historical issues here, but back in the 1950s, back when I was born, 60 years ago, if you were an adult adoptee in Oregon, you could go and get your adoption records. They were open, they weren't sealed. Around 1957, they were sealed. They remain sealed until today. During that time, there was secrecy, I would say, in the 50s, the 60s, some of the 1970s, but things, well, times, they started to change. And we began to open up some of the information. We began with the Voluntary Adoption Registry. The problem with the Voluntary Adoption Registry, it's a good thing, but it's voluntary, and if both sides, so if the birth parent and the adoptee both register, they can match up. If one of them doesn't, then they don't. So it's an imperfect system. We went from there to, in the early 1990s, the Oregon legislature passed a law that said we can have open adoption agreements. Since 1993, and I've watched this progression over my years of practice, most adoptions in Oregon are open to some extent. People share identities. They share phone numbers. They email one another. They text each other. They share Facebook pages today, all this social media. There isn't the secrecy that we had many years ago. We have this openness now in Oregon that I like it. I think it's very special. And the people that I work with adoptive parents, I work with birth parents, I work with grandparents who sometimes adopt their grandchildren or who are trying to see their grandchildren. All of these people are now more open with one another, but we haven't opened up the court records, and that's what this bill would do. It would take 7.211, move it into a more logical position in Oregon statutes, make it easier for people to find. I'll give you a quick little story. Last week I got an email from a colleague, and he said, I represent someone who was adopted by his grandparents in the 1960s. He'd like to get a copy of the court file. I don't know how to do it. I found this statute. I think this is what I would use, but what's the process? What do I do? Can I go ex parte in front of a judge? What do I do? And I was able to email him and say, well, look at 7.211, but also go look at Senate Bill 623, because if this passes, this will make your job for this gentleman much, much easier. And in fact, he will be able to go down to Multnomah County Courthouse and get a copy of his adoption record. And that's the immediate impact that you could have by supporting this bill and passing it on the House floor. When I was here in mid-March in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I had just been substituted in on two sibling adoptions in Marion County. I went to the courthouse with my substitution of attorney forms and met the probate clerk who said, well, you can look at this file, but you can't look at that one because it's been sealed. Go prepare a motion and order, submit it ex parte, and we'll consider your motion. So for two siblings, I got treated differently as the attorney of record. If Senate Bill 623 passes, I won't have to do that as the attorney of record. I'll be able to walk in, put in my notice of substitution, and I'll be able to look at that record and figure out what it is I need to do to finish that adoption. That's all I needed to do. I needed to figure out what was in the file and what wasn't there. Right now, we don't have guidelines, we don't have clarity, and we don't have consistency. A judge in Multnomah County can decide to open records or not, and they can decide on a different basis than a judge down in Lakeview or in Marion County or in any of the other counties in Oregon, because we lack those guidelines and that clarity. And part of what 623 does is it provides those things to all of us, to the judiciary and court staff, so they'll know who can get what and when. And that's what we did. If you saw our report, Wendy did this wonderful matrix. Actually, the matrix is to be credited to Mr. Whitwer here. He, in one of our work group sessions, he came up with this matrix. And that's what we did. We played with it, and we said, all right, out of the stakeholders in an adoption, who should get what part of the court file, and when should they get it? And what you see in front of you, 623, is the result of all of that discussion and work. I would love to see you pass this bill and support it without opposition. If you'll notice, I don't think we have any opposition. We didn't face any opposition in the Senate. This basically is, to my mind, a law improvement bill. It's going to improve our law. It's going to improve the practice by attorneys. I don't know, some of you are attorneys, some of you are not. Attorneys are self-insured in Oregon by the Professional Liability Fund, and I do work for the PLF. They call it being a repair attorney. And so sometimes an attorney makes a mistake on an adoption case, and so the PLF will contact someone like me and ask me to help fix it. So we try to repair it. What we've done, not only in terms of the open records here, but in terms of what we've done with addressing the needs of the petition and the segregated information form, is we have made more clarity and more efficiency, I believe, and just made it so that court staff, attorneys, litigants, we're going to know what is needed to be in that petition, and it's not going to be all over the place in a shotgun approach, but it's all gathered together and very clearly outlined. So for all of these reasons, I would encourage you to support this bill and to send it to the House with your full approval. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair Barker and the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Laura Batt, and I am an adoption professional, but I'm also an adopted person and a birth parent. And I'm actually coming here just because I appreciate the opportunity that Oregon will be able to possibly give this to adopted people and birth parents and adoptive families, because I was adopted in Idaho, and even if this passes, I still will not have access to my records. But thankfully, when 15 years ago when I went to search for my biological family, I had resources that helped connect us. And it was such a profound experience for me, and I think that it's such an emotional process to go and access information that you've not had access to. If we can make anything like the path clearer for people, then it will be less stressful and they'll know what to do. And if somebody doesn't need this information, then they don't have to access it. But if they do need it, it should be easier. Every time as an adoptive person you go to the doctor, people ask you your medical history. They ask you questions about where you come from, and you're treated differently if you're records are sealed and you aren't given this information. So I think it's a rights thing that adopted people don't have access. And also biological parents and adoptive parents can't get things that they signed. I mean, usually when you sign a contract for something important, you could get a copy of it. And once this is finalized, you can't get copies of that. And why shouldn't people be able to do that? It makes sense.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is John Whitwer. I'm also a private attorney. By the grayness of my hair and the lack of it, you know I've been at it for a while and kind of as an old hand, I always pull back a little bit when the legislature tells me I have to do anything, including what kind of papers I should file in a case that I feel perfectly competent to handle. But in this case where we're curing some organizational problems with what the contents of what goes into an adoption file, I fully support this bill and its effort to clarify what needs to be in an adoption file on the front end. And I also support fully from practice in representing adoption agencies, adoptees, birth parents, putative fathers, grandparents, anyone connected in any way with adoptions. I've been there, done that. This bill, we frankly could come up with no good reason not to pass this bill. When we were confronted with the question of why shouldn't people have access to this information, there was no constituency speaking. And I have to say that the process of working out the language was intriguing, but we reached a very commonsensical approach. I, for one, don't like to make changes either just because the wind happens to be blowing in that direction. But there should be a principled approach to these rules and these standards for adoption cases, particularly which are such of high importance to many people. And in this case, we've addressed, I think, in a very principled manner, access to records and distinguished the categories of persons who should and should not have access readily. That being said, there still should be some judicial oversight for those cases in which it's not an obvious access permission. And so the bill provides for that. And I fully support it and encourage you to support it as well.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Representative Tobin.
Thank you. This probably isn't pertinent to this bill, but some years ago, maybe it doesn't happen so much now, that when someone had a child, perhaps out of wedlock or whatever, and the child was adopted, they wanted to remain anonymous. They did not want to be found. That probably this has been addressed long before I have any expertise or experience in this issue, but could one of you address that?
Yeah, we don't promise that to any. In my experience, I've been practicing for 8 years, and there's not anything in any of the forms that we complete with people that promises that. I think it was verbally promised because people were felt, they were made to feel shameful for getting pregnant. Mm-hmm. And so it was put on people in the process of protecting that information just because of the time. But really, the thing about this is that most of the people who are this is going to impact are grown adults. And if they contacted somebody and that person didn't want to have contact, all the adult adoptees I know that if it didn't work out or the contact weren't receptive, then they just say, okay, well, I wanted you to know that I'm alive and I'm okay, and then they respect their wishes. I think it's really a representation of the way adoption occurred during a certain time period, which is why it closed. But it's really catching the law up with what the practice is.
And if I might add something in response, also Chair Barker and Representative Tomei, in my practice, I've been handling adoptions since the mid-1980s, and I would have to say that I've never represented a birth parent who asked for anonymity. The people I've represented who wanted anonymity sometimes would be the adoptive parents more than the birth parents. And we've really grown away from that, and I tell people that in today's world, in Oregon at least, if you do an adoption, in all likelihood, it will be an open adoption. And part of that is the birth parents have come to that. They want the openness. And so I think that's those thoughts were in our minds, and we actually discussed issues like that in our work group quite extensively. I hope that helps.
It does, yeah. If I may, Mr. Chair. I think in past times, certainly people did want that kind of anonymity. I think that has changed in the culture.
Yes, I would agree. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. Chairman Barker and Representative Tomei, also, I'd just add that going back to this concept of a principled approach to something, you cannot deny the biological reality. That's true. And despite paternity and maternity being a legal concept, not a biological concept, That biological connection is extremely powerful, and it's true. The facts of a child's birth will never be other than what they are, and for our law to create this artificial barrier around that truth and shield that truth from someone, I think, is just not an appropriate approach.
Thank you. And I think it has, I mean, it's certainly evolved. When I was a teenager, that was still a big deal where the girl usually went to visit an aunt for a while and came home, and then they did try to keep that. And I know people who are my age who have had the child show up later on, and sometimes that worked, sometimes it didn't. But it's
world's changed. I think it's much better to have it open, and everybody knows it's open, and then there's no, especially with the medical considerations and things that we are able to do these days. Okay, thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
Diana Godwin, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm Diana Godwin. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I'm here specifically to support Senate Bill 623, and particularly Section 6, Subsection 4. I represent a client who is now 53 years old. He has a very, very tragic history. He was born to, first his parents had a son, and then they had my client. My client was born in 1960. In 1963, it's 1962, his father was killed in a tragic car accident. 6 months later, his mother was killed in a tragic car accident. So the two young boys were left. They were sort of abandoned down in Santa Barbara. And their grandfather, their biological grandfather, and their step-grandmother adopted them. In the meantime, their biological grandmother had killed herself in Hawaii. It was just an incredible story. And the children came to live with the grandfather and the step-grandmother, but were not adopted for about 5 years, and we don't know why. But in 1968, the grandparents adopted these two children, these two boys. But the interesting thing about it was that the day they were adopted, they were given the grandparents' name, something of a well-known name, but instantly within that day, there was a separate court order reversing that and giving them back the names of their birth parents, which was sort of interesting. And then they grew up in this family. It was sort of a blended family with stepbrothers and sisters. And they grew into young adulthood. And the older brother of my client was tragically killed, was trying to stop a robbery at his hardware store. And through these years, it's never been clear to my client what the circumstances were of somewhat of his parents' deaths. Until just a few years ago, he couldn't even locate his biological father's grave. He didn't understand why he hadn't been adopted for about 5 years. Now, he came to me about this in about 2001, and I said, but he wasn't ready to open the records, or petition to open the records, because his step-grandmother, or his mother, was still alive. His biological grandfather had died. And now his mother, his step-grandmother, adopted mother, just died at Christmas time. And my client has struggled with some tremendous emotional issues about what happened in his adoption. And we have, again, it was my associate attorney who contacted Ms. Pope and said, we're now ready to open these records. How do we do that? Well, I don't know. We'll sort of make it up as we go along. Can we do it ex parte? What's the petition look like? What constitutes good cause? Where do we go? Do we name Department of Human Services as a party, serve them? And so this bill will help my client tremendously. All interested parties are dead, other than my client. And so he's just, for his own emotional health and understanding what happened to him, we support subsection 4, which is the provision that says, after the minor child who is the subject of the adoption proceeding has attained 18 years of age, he may inspect and copy sealed records with the exception of the home study. And we don't know whether or not in 1960s whether such a home study was done. We further support the retroactive provision in Section 16 of this bill that will make the provisions of this bill applicable to my client's somewhat unique case. I surely appreciate the opportunity today and happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you for any questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 623A and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 623A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 623A to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Williamson will be our carrier.
open a work session on Senate Bill 623. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, you may remember this companion bill from the Law Commission. This relates to records in juvenile court proceedings. You have before you the bill. You also have the A10 and A11 amendments. The A10 amendments come to you from the Youth Rights and Justice Group out of Portland, and they basically, I think the most important part of the bill is at the end, and it places a sunset provision. The bill provisions become operative on July 1, 2014, and that goes back to who has access to the records and allows other parties, of course, may want to allow access to it. Then you have the Dash 11 amendments that come from Mike Livingston for the behalf of the Judicial Department, and they go to page 3 of the bill. Let me read as they would be amended. The clerk of the court shall keep a supplemental confidential file for each case and a record of each case except as otherwise provided in ORS 7.120. 7.120 relates the presiding judge of the judicial district may authorize destruction of any court record or document. So basically it ties the records back in to what the courts already do now, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
We have all the paperwork and both amendments.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Chris, you want to move that one? 622A. Well, we'll move the dash 10s and 11s in first on 622.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 10s.
Representative Garrett moves the dash 10 amendments into Senate Bill 622. Is there any discussion?
I have a question about it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I just heard of them today. Could perhaps the council explain it to me one more time, what this amendment is?
Chair, members of the committee, this goes to the operative date of certain information as who would have access to it. If you look at the amendments, it says, for example, from the beginning.
I see.
Okay. The clerk of the court shall keep a record of each case and a supplemental confidential file for each case. And that I'm reading on page 1, line 17. And then it goes over to the next page, and it relates to who may have access, any person allowed by the court. It lists a whole group of individuals who have access. This is talking about confidential files.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes effect on July 2014. This gives the parties a chance to think who the other parties would be. And maybe Mr. McKechnie can explain it better than I can because it is his amendment. That's
perhaps
basically what the amendment does.
And a follow-up, how does this amendment, to give the, I know there's pending litigation involving the Oregonian, is this to essentially let that have time to sort itself out?
I see they're shaking their heads up, yes.
Okay.
So that would give the.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Are there any objections to the Dash 10 amendments? Seeing none, they're so ordered to be entered.
And Mr. Chair, move the Dash 11 amendments to the Senate
Representative,
Bill 622.
Representative Garrett moves the Dash 11 amendments into Senate Bill 622. Is there any discussion or questions? Mm-hmm. Are there any objections?
Could that be explained to me one more time, please?
Okay.
The Dash 11.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a very complicated bill. The Dash 11 amendments, if you go over to page 3, lines 3 through 7, and I'll read it again as amended. The clerk of the court shall keep, and then it takes out a record of each case and goes on, a supplemental confidential file for each case, and then it adds in a record for each case except as otherwise provided in R 7.120. And 7.120 allows the presiding judge of the judicial district to authorize destruction of any court record or document. This doesn't mean the supplemental file is going to be destroyed. It means that anything that's been entered into as an exhibit in the court proceedings may at some time in the future be destroyed. Mr. Livingston can probably explain it better than I can, but that's what I understand the amendment does. That seems to be the plain meaning of the language, and that's what I got from him when I discussed this issue before the meeting with him.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Is there any other questions? Are there any objections to the Dash 11 amendments? Seeing none, they're ordered in.
The Chair moves Senate Bill 622 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Krieger moves, Representative Garrett moves Senate Bill 622 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Again, seeing none, so ordered. Representative Garrett, would you like to carry the bill for us?
Okay. Good idea, Mr. Chair. Perhaps Greg Matthews.
I said the wrong name, so you get it. So I get the right name.
Oh, God.
Is there any further business coming?
I'll be coming to see all of you.
We are adjourned. Thank you.